You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today our guest is Neil Herbert, the Executive Chairman of Atlantic Lithium. So welcome onto the podcast, Neil. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me here today.
Well, no, thank you very much for joining us. And of course, my co-host is a different co-host today. It's not Scottish Kenny. It's someone who we can hopefully understand far more clearly because she has very good pronounced English. It's Katrina. Hello, Katrina. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. All the way in here, over here in Barcelona.
You're over in Barcelona. Okay, I'm over in Rotterdam. Where are you calling from, Neil?
I'm in Lisbon.
You're in Lisbon.
Okay, so very European presence today. Okay. Good. Well, it's certainly very chilly today in Rotterdam. What's it like with you? I'm terribly British to talk about the weather, but hopefully it's a bit warmer with you, Katrina.
It is a bit, yes. I mean, this is why we live here, you know, to be in warmer climes. And Neil, are you based in Lisbon? Or?
Yeah, so I actually live just outside Lisbon and I have for the last 7 years. But interestingly enough, I worked and lived in Spain for many years. My wife is Spanish. I worked in the south. I worked in the north. I worked with Pricewaterhouse there. So very familiar. And it was really a toss-up between Barcelona and Lisbon when I decided to come and live here. And in the end, I decided to come to Lisbon. So there you go. It could have been Barcelona.
And how did Lisbon win?
And to be honest, I came here for a weekend and I just had a wonderful time. I did a lot of work in Spain and a little bit in Portugal in the 90s. And to be honest, Portugal at that time wasn't as interested as living in Spain, but I came here for a weekend and it must have been 8-9 years ago. And I was actually really impressed by the place. And I don't actually like hot weather that much. So the influence of the Atlantic Ocean actually works quite well for me. And if nothing else, the thing I really enjoy about living down here is the light, to be honest. It just has great light most of the year. Mm. At the moment, actually, it's overcast and raining, so I can't say that today.
Right. Okay. Then the accent is interesting, I hear.
My accent's all over the place, I understand. I can't hear it, but everybody else can. I've worked a lot with Australians and South Africans and even Scottish mining engineers, and I think it's gone astray somewhere, but I can't really say where.
Right. Mark?
Well, I mean, yeah, we can certainly get an idea maybe of where that accent has taken its cues from with your vast career history, Neil. So I wonder, what we like to focus on this podcast is really the people within the business, because ultimately when people are investing in companies, I think they invest in the people as well as the projects and, of course, its prospects, because you can have an awesome mining project, but if you've got the wrong sort of people running that company or taking that into development, then ultimately the company is not going to do very well. And I can see you've got a very vast history in the mining space. I wonder, just for the first sort of 5-10 minutes or so, if you could perhaps just start us off by taking us back through, you know, some of your early stages in life, when you left university and your early interests and then your foray into the mining sector.
Yeah, sure. Happy to do that. So I went to the University of Leicester, where I studied a joint honours in economics and economic history. thought about getting a real job, but then decided not to. I went and did several other things, went and ran a restaurant, amongst other things. Went to live in Spain for a few years, taught English, and eventually ended up joining Pricewaterhouse. So I guess that was a couple of years after university, when I was sort of 24, 25, and worked several years with them. And as I was a Spanish speaker by that stage, it was the UK firm, and they sent me to work in Gibraltar for a time. So I worked down in Gib. And then after that, I worked for the Spanish firm, and I had a range of clients, which included the resource sector. I had Shell and I had Phelps Dodge on the mining side, but didn't have a particular emphasis on the resources sector. And it was only when I returned to the UK in the later 90s that actually I got into the mining industry. I just happened to see in the Financial Times an advertisement to join the team at Antofagasta. And so Antofagasta at that point in time wasn't really a mining company as such. It held a series of interests in Chile, including breweries and vineyards and lots of lovely businesses. But the thing that they were now focusing on was mining. And so they had one small underground mine, a copper mine in Chile, which was Machia. And they were in the process of taking or building a mine, which was Palambres, which was really a game changer for the company. And I think the market capitalization of the company was something like 150 million sterling at the time. Palambres was a game changer really for the company. And so it propelled it to the company that it is today, which I think is something like 20 billion sterling. So we built that mine. It was a tremendous mine. It's been a huge success, still operating today. Obviously the early years were just tremendous cash flow. We also built another mine in up in the Atacama Desert called El Tesoro. So we had significant increase in copper. We became a very significant copper producer from being, if you like, almost no production at all. And it was a very interesting experience to go through, and I suppose really got my interest in the mining sector running, and you could see the opportunity. And obviously what happened with copper prices were very low at the end of the 90s. But as the Chinese boom occurred, obviously copper and indeed other minerals became much in demand. Prices rose significantly. And as is always the case in this sector, when demand rises quickly, it's very difficult to bring in new supply very quickly. So it takes often 10 years to bring a new mine on. So the profits generated by Antofagasta were really quite phenomenal during that period. On the people side, it was very good to work with the Lutzak family, who had the controlling stake in the company. They knew how to operate in Chile. They knew how to build a company and bring in the expertise that they didn't have. So again, it was a very interesting experience from that side as well. From there, I went on to, I became the CFO of Branco Holdings. And so Branco Holdings was one of the first AIM companies. They actually told me it was AIM company number one. I don't actually know that, but it was certainly the first big AIM success in the mining sector. The company got sold in 2002, I think it was, for $368 million or something, which was a lot of money at the time. So that was a gold project in Argentina. And we went on from that to, I worked with another company, which was Kalahari Diamonds, which never got listed. It had a large stake in it, which was controlled by BHP Billiton. And in the end, we sold that on to Petra Diamonds. And from there, I went on to work with Galahad Gold. And Galahad effectively had a series of investments. It had taken quite large stakes, sort of 20-30% stakes in companies where we saw the value or proposition for the mineral concern to be very good. Had a very large stake in what was the copper gold project at Pebble in Alaska, which we eventually sold on, I think, to Rio. A series of other interests, all of which got sold on in time. But the one I ended up looking after was the sort of the orphan at the time, which was a uranium company we made an investment in for $5 million for 26% in 2005. And there was, you know, lots of issues with it. So I ended up spending nearly all my time working on it, and then listing it on AIM and then listing it onto the TSX main board. But it turned out to be one of those wonderful stories because I started working with a chap called Ian Stork, who I've often worked on in projects, who's a Scottish engineer by background. And we propelled the company from, as I say, a very low market capitalization to a sale for $2.5 billion in 2 years. So I worked very closely with the French acquirer, and obviously they ended up buying that project. And it just so happened it coincided with a very rapid rise in uranium prices, which also helped a lot in terms of the revaluation of the company. So again, you see that dynamic there with the price, where you've got rapidly changing demand scenarios pushing up the price and creating opportunity for new mines. From that, I went on to work with a company called Polo Resources, which I joined. It had a series of coal assets in it, but then turned it into an investment company in the same way as we'd worked with Galahad Gold. So focused, unsurprisingly, on the energy side, mainly into, we had some coal assets, mainly into uranium again. We had a big stake in Extract, which was a major project the Chinese eventually acquired, and also into oil and gas. Paid out special dividends, I think, of over $200 million in my time as managing director there. So that ended about 2013, which is when I semi-retired, at least for a while, and took a break. Looked at opportunity in the industrial mineral sector again. Obviously, prices were very low at the time. There was very low interest in the sector. Worked with a helium company, so I became chairman of, which is now Helium One. So I was chairman of it until its listing. It went through a very difficult licensing cycle, which I was heavily involved in Tanzania to sort out licensing issues. And once resolved, eventually I stood down from that one. In the meantime, in 2000, and I'm trying to think now, it must have been about 2014 or so, I was approached by what is now Atlantic Lithium. And I came in as their independent non-executive director when they listed it. And a couple of years later, the major shareholders asked me if I would become chairman. So I became non-executive chairman. And earlier this year, very sadly, the founder of the company and my dear friend, Vincent Muscolo, died of a heart attack. And so I stood in as executive chairman. So I'm now the senior exec on the company. Mm-hmm. And it's a company which, to be honest, has a very good asset. It's a lithium asset in Ghana. And as the brokers have described it, best in class. So it's just a very good prospect indeed.
Excellent. Well, I mean, I know you've shortened that down, because looking on your LinkedIn page, there are a few more positions there. But I mean, all in mining. I mean, the takeaway I get from that is that really you started out sort of in finance, really doing economics, university. Mm. Getting to work for PwC, of course, the huge accountancy firm, but then quickly moving into those similar roles, financial roles in mining companies. And then I guess getting that sort of, dare I say it, the mining bug, perhaps. Was that fair to say?
It's fair to say. It's a fascinating sector to work in. And certainly, as I say, I mean, if you stand back at it, you can just see the changing the changing demand side as technology changes. Mm. You can see this very much with lithium at the moment with EVs, but you can see it with a range of minerals, and particularly in the industrial segment. It actually provides some real opportunity to bring some new mines forward and do some new projects, which is always fun.
I mean, and talking on that, building new projects, you've gone from building from early stage, almost grassroots in some instances, to building seriously big, or certainly part of that journey, seriously big companies worth a lot of money, and you know, but being involved with them from the early stages. I mean, what is that sort of experience like? You must have learned an awful lot going through those processes.
Yes, I mean, it goes back to your comment at the beginning. It's actually, obviously, you need a good project, you need a good deposit to be able to do something with it. But what really makes a difference here is always the people. So it's finding the right people at the right time for those projects. And it always requires something of a transformation, because often the people who find the projects, the exploration team, when they're successful, you need to move on to a mining team. And we have this at Atlantic now. Obviously, we've had a really successful exploration team. They identified this project out of a series of projects that we were working on. And now we obviously need to transfer and transition to the mining side. So you've got three stages here: the exploration stage, the project, the build team, and then you have the mining side. And actually, to create a smooth transition there is not always easy. And so actually working with the right people who have the right mindset is always a pleasure.
When you talk about people and the right mindset, what is it to you that is the right mindset in the mining arena?
I would say, and it's true of everything in life, it's accept what you don't know and bring in people who know what you don't know. So, at the moment, I've just brought in on Atlantic a new COO. I'm very fortunate to have him. He's one of the few people that's actually run a hard rock lithium mine. So to bring him in on Atlantic now, when we are taking this mine, which is a very similar mine, he ran the Mount Catlin mine in Australia. We have a very similar setup to bring him in at this stage so that we can start transitioning towards the mining team. And he provides a lot of insight that we otherwise don't have. And the culture of exploration to the culture of mining are very different cultures. So being able to manage those transition and bringing in the right people at the right time so that you get the results is key. And occasionally in my career, you have met explorationists who have been successful who sometimes find it very hard to let go of their project. They identify very strongly with it. And sometimes in this industry, you see projects effectively being held back because they don't have the right people involved. But fortunately, for most of my career, I think I've managed to avoid that. And, we've worked with people who are constructive, who were all looking for the same outcome.
Mm-hmm. And just relating to people, when is it, in terms of in the mining industry, can you give examples of, projects that might have gone wrong because you didn't have the right people?
Name names. That's a terrible thing, isn't it? I mean, I can work on to be honest, you do come across it quite often, and I'm not going to name names, but you do find it quite often where you've got somebody who's actually made a great discovery and well done for making the discovery, but not willing to let go and not really having that expertise to know how to develop it or indeed know how to finance the development. And the project just, if you like, stagnates for years as a result. And that's a big shame, frankly, because it's in everybody's interest that these projects get done when you need the mineral for changing technologies. So I'm not going to name any names, but it does happen out there, and I can understand why people get very possessive when they feel they've made a great discovery. But you need to know when to, if you like, stand back and let other people come forward who have the experience to take it to mining.
It's a hard thing to do, though, I think, isn't it? Particularly if you've taken a long, long, long time to make that discovery. I know a couple of companies, again, I won't name any names, who you just think, yeah, you've made that discovery, but now is the time to bring someone else in to actually, because it's a far cry from making a discovery to actually taking it to, it's a completely different ball game.
It's a completely different business. It's chalk and cheese.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of message is quite important, I think, for a lot of companies. There's something I want to pick up on. I think you talked there about when we talk about the listed companies, public companies, and you've actually been involved with bringing companies to market. You talked about there maybe being aim number one, whether that's true or not, but you've actually been through a listing process. So you must be fairly clued up and in tune, let's say, with the market and aligned with shareholders. So how have you found that involvement? Because, of course, you've got your accountancy back, your finance background, and then your mining experience. But, of course, there's the other element as well, the corporate angle as well, and looking after shareholders.
Yeah, it's very important, I think, to engage with shareholders. And obviously, things have changed an awful lot in my 20-odd years of dealing with public markets. So today, and I've seen this at Atlantic, because as I say, I kind of stood back a bit in 2013, and it's interesting to come to it now because you obviously have a lot more media than you used to have. And the availability, you need to be more available to your shareholders so that they can see you and ask you questions. And actually, it's a great thing because, I was doing, I think I did one last night with LSE. And so you do a short presentation, people ask you questions. There are lots of different platforms which you can go on and people can get access to you. So that is, I think, is a big change. And I think people expect and demand a lot more engagement than they used to. It's not a question of getting the odd article in the press and the Daily Mail anymore. That's simply not enough. You need to be out there and talking to your investors so they understand what you're doing and how the project is going. And it's a very reasonable thing for people to expect. I mean, obviously, you know, you've got to run the company and you've got to progress the projects. And this is an ancillary activity to that. But finance the company is equally important, and ensuring that, you know, value is, you create value and you're seen to create value is important to investors. And yes, the level of engagement is much higher than it used to be.
It really is. I mean, yesterday I was talking to a private investor. He's younger than me. He's I think he said he was 32, and he started investing when he was 15 years old. He said his granddad sort of got him into it, and he told me that they used to read the back of the papers, and they would go down to the bank or the post office, and they would buy and get the share certificate. I'm like, I've never
isn't
done
that fabulous?
Fabulous, but that's only, you know, in 15 years. You know, that's how it's changed now with information that's so available. And you're so right. If companies aren't engaging or aren't making use of what's available to everyone at their fingertips now, this instant gratification, then they're not going to fare very well in the markets. But this is also an interesting point because, you know, the mining sector does not usually give instant gratification unless you're extremely lucky that you buy a stock one week and then the next week they've hit that discovery. You have to have quite a longer term mindset, I think, don't you, in the exploration space. It's not sort of as rapid moving as like tech or something like that. I mean, do you think investors, have you found the shift of mindset of investors in this space? Do you think people need a sentiment, you know, a mindset check that they can't, you know, have a real short-term mindset? They've got to plan for the longer term with mining and invest for the journey.
Well, I guess that you can always hope for the big hit. I mean, I guess we come back to the comment before, there's exploration and there's mining. So when you're in the exploration side, obviously everybody's excited about your next set of results and your next set of drill results particularly. And it does drive the share price. I guess the if you come onto the mining side, and you know, I have this at the moment at Atlantic because we're transitioning to the mining team and taking the project to production. So we're in production the year after next. Then it becomes a very different thing. So obviously the risk profile changes dramatically. So I guess overall it's much lower risk than doing exploration, and you're also getting nearer to, you know, cash flows and becoming a cash flowing company, where when you're doing exploration, you're forever raising money to explore for the next project. Yes, I mean, people, you know, do need to be patient, but we don't necessarily live in patient times now, do we? I think we've all got a little bit used to having instant gratification and the next set of news on Twitter. You have to measure. I mean, at the end of the day, you can't provide news that doesn't exist. So you can only tell people what's going on. I think it's important to be there and tell them what's going on, but you can't make it up.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about, I mean, you know, the mining sector cycles. I mean, how often do those change? And, you know, how can you sort of know what to invest in terms of what's relevant, what's current right now? So, you know, we talked about lithium and gold and diamonds, you know, mm-hmm. How do you keep up with those cycles of mining?
So I think it's always, looking into the crystal ball is always a dangerous game, but you have to look in the crystal ball a little bit. And some things are relatively easy to see, particularly when they start to get momentum. And that's certainly true with what's happening with the EV revolution. And then that's, you know, if I was to make the comparison, the early noughties, we saw the massive expansion of China and its thirst for just about every mineral possible in the industrial sector. Meant that prices rose significantly, and we saw a huge boom in prices. You know, that settled down in the, you know, after the 2008 crisis. We had a good run for a couple of years, and then it was very quiet, really, in the sector for a significant period of time. What's changing now, and we can see this, is we have major changes in technology going on, which is requiring new minerals, and particularly in the industrial segment, to come forward. So if you look at the case of EVs, you can check this out online. There's a number of estimates of what that means in terms of new mining projects. So Benchmark Minerals do a particularly good analysis. So they forecast that we'll need 59 new lithium mines in the next decade. They also work out how many graphite mines you need, more copper mines you need, and more nickel mines you need. It's probably been more acute with lithium because there was production of lithium historically was very low because it wasn't needed in that many applications. So, you know, a dramatic change due to the EVs. I mean, 59 new mines in a decade is an incredible number. The average time it takes to bring a mine to production is 10 years. So unless you've got projects that have been mothballed, where there are one or two out there, or projects that have already been studied, it's very difficult to move those forward quickly enough to fill the demand gap. And so what happens is that the sector is effectively supply constrained and prices remain high. The case of lithium at the last auction I saw was over $8,700 a ton. The Ewoyaa project we have is truly an exceptional project, and it's very low capex opex, but the opex on the project is something like $287 a ton. So you can see that the price differential there, the margin that can be achieved, is huge. But we don't work on the basis that you're going to have $8,000 lithium forever. The project that you have at Ewoyaa is going to be one of the lowest cost companies there is. So even if the price crashed tomorrow, it would be one of the last mines to close. So we actually model for our feasibility study. I think we used an average of $1,360. So that's a fraction of the current price of the lithium. And working even with that number, that average price, we get payback in something like 20 weeks. So normally in the mining industry, we talk about payback of capex in years. So be able to talk about project repayment of its finance within, you know, a matter of weeks is quite an event in my career. I don't think I've had that before.
Mm-hmm. I mean, also talking about mining, I mean, obviously people now are much more sort of conscious about how they mine, the sustainability factor, which I see at Atlantic Lithium are conscious of the way they're mining these days. Can you sort of talk more about that?
Yeah, I think sustainability has actually become, you know, a huge issue for the mining industry and very sensitive about how it's perceived. And you've seen what's actually some very good things have happened, and particularly when you're working in remote areas. Traditionally, what you'd have to do is, where there was not good power, you would have diesel gensets. I mean, the reality is that a lot of mines are having built next to them solar panel farms in Africa to provide power. And that's actually a huge improvement in terms of for the industry, that you don't actually have to ship large amounts of oil over long distances to be able to serve the mines. It's actually a huge advantage. Indeed, you know, we're also big sponsors of hydropower as well for new projects. So that side's very good. We're very sensitive on the environmental side too. I mean, we're very fortunate at the project at Atlantic, because to be honest, it's just a very straightforward proposition in terms of mining and processing. Because it's an all spodumene project, you don't need to go into flotation. So if you go into flotation, you're using a lot more energy. You also have more tailings. It's a very different prospect. So most projects in Africa have that scenario, which we don't face, what we have with it at Ewoyaa. And we also benefit from the existing infrastructure. So actually, we don't have to do a great deal in terms of bringing the mine to production. It already has grid power across the site. The power comes from a big hydro dam in country. We're only 110 kilometers from the port, so that's a relatively small footprint in that respect, and the port facility is already built. So we also work very closely with the community to make sure that they're comfortable with what we're doing, and the government. And to be fair, you know, Ghana has a long history of mining. It has a very established mining regime, has an awful lot of well-qualified personnel. They work throughout the world. I met them in Australia and South Africa and other places. So we're overwhelmingly got local content into the project as well. We have one expat employee currently working country. Everybody else is a Ghanaian.
Amazing. So getting the local community involved, which is great.
Yeah, getting the local community involved and, you know, employing in the local community. We do, you know, a lot of employment through the local community, but also, you know, I will say we don't need to go overseas to find qualified staff, which is a big advantage in Ghana because it's got such a well-established mining industry. And we're quite a popular employer. We recently advertised for a post, and we had 500 applications, and a lot of them highly qualified. And a lot of that also reflects is that most of the mines in Ghana in the far north, so these remote locations, are taking people away from their families, whereas our project is actually based near the coast and 100 kilometers from Accra, the capital. So you could actually, for a lot of people, they could, you know, come to work and go home at the end of the day and be with their families. So we've been quite a popular company when it comes to employment.
Right. Okay.
Good, 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 good. Well, we've started talking there about the project. I just wonder if you can sort of just give us an idea of what stage it's at. You've got the DFS done, haven't you? And the project's fully funded to 103 million. Is that right?
Yeah. So where we are is that we've done the pre-feasibility study,
okay,
which we concluded in September. We've moved the resource up from 20 million tons start of the year up to 30 million tons.
Mm-hmm.
So we're now doing the definitive feasibility studies, which is the focus study, because as you pointed out, we're not looking for financing here. So we entered into a joint venture agreement with Piedmont Lithium. So Piedmont Lithium's ultimate interest, obviously, is having feedstock for its two hydroxide plants that it's building in North America. So they're earning into 50% of the project by providing, okay, as you say, over 100 million of funding, 70 million of which is devoted to CapEx. In the pre-feasibility study, we had CapEx of 125 million. So they're responsible for the first 70 million and half of the remaining amount. So in terms of funding that balance, we currently have a good cash position of about $15 million today. Okay. But we also have been talking to, and it's been mentioned before, to the Ghana Sovereign Wealth Fund. So we're not planning to do any other financings with the exception of the Sovereign Wealth Fund, because it'd be very important to have them on board. They have recently completed their due diligence. They've given it a thumbs up. So really, we're just waiting on them to see when they make an investment decision, and we'll talk to them about that when they have.
So you don't want to do the financing because they don't want to get diluted out. Is that the idea?
No, so they would come in. They would come in as shareholders at top level. So there's no particular complication to their investments. So they'd just be like any other investor joining the company.
Okay.
We would very much like to have them on board, because obviously having local content at the ownership level, as much as indeed in terms of our workforce, etc., is important to us.
Well, that's a big vote of confidence, having the Sovereign Wealth Fund hopefully becoming a major shareholder. And the joint venture then with Piedmont Lithium, they can earn up to 50%. Is that what you said?
Yeah, they're earning 50%, okay, by making their commitment for 103 million. Mm-hmm. And by making that, they also have the rights to offtake. So they can buy 50% of the offtake at market price.
They can buy 50% of the offtake at market price. Okay. And they're a United States company, are they?
Yeah, so they're North American. They were originally listed on the ASX, but the company has an overwhelming North American focus. So they are now listed in the States. And they also they have their own lithium project in North Carolina, but they're in the process of taking forward the building of two hydroxide plants. They're beneficiaries of the IRA, the recent legislation in the United States, which provides funding for the project. So they're quite advanced with that. They've been a very good partner, to be honest. We have regular technical meetings. They're very supportive. They input into the project. We also have our biggest shareholder, which is a major South African mining house called Assore. So they have a 25% stake at Top Company, so in Atlantic Lithium. So they recently increased that, having done a full review of the project and given it a thumbs up. So that's also an endorsement. So they, I think the week before last, they increased their stake to 25%, which is quite nice.
I mean, these are big endorsements at this stage as well, where you're still just in PFS stage and going into the DFS throughout next year. I mean, Piedmont Lithium, are they... part of the strategic aspect of the United States wanting to source homegrown projects rather than relying on the Chinese for these important commodities for the green EV revolution?
Very much so. And I was at a conference in LA the week before last, and we now have $150 billion as being committed to building gigafactories. So there's a fundamental change going on here. But the big problem, to be frank, and it's great that they have that level of a commitment already, However, the fundamental problem is the lack of supply of raw materials, yeah. because you can't feed a plant without supply. So there is a scramble from these companies to actually secure supply. So obviously the deal with Piedmont Lithium gives them a right to 50% of the offtake from mm-hmm. a project, let's say at market price. But the remaining 50% at the moment is unencumbered. So we're free to do what we want with it. So we've been obviously had a lot of inquiries from companies obviously a lot in China, because that is the main location for these plants at the current time, but also increasingly from the US and from Europe.
I mean, I was talking to someone the other day, a commodities investor. He's a big data guy. He told me he modeled all the mines. He runs a hedge fund. And he gave me some astonishing facts back in the summer. And one of the things that really sticks in my mind is if we're going to go down this green shift route, we have to create the investment of 6 United States of Americas over the next 30 years. And most of it has to happen in the next 10. It's an incredible, incredible amount of investment in this space. And we talked briefly about cycles. I mean, a commodity super cycle, it's got to start. I think not just yet, but when it kicks, it's really got to go, I think. What are your thoughts on that?
The reality is, obviously this is not something that's happened in our lifetime before. So, you know, we are a little bit numb to it all. But the reality is that what is happening in technology is a once in a 100-year event. I mean, we haven't seen this sort of change since the introduction of the internal combustion engine. And the result of this changing technology is enormous in terms of its mineral requirements and its changing mineral requirements. So the next 10 years, as I say, the benchmark guys do a very good analysis that it is actually staggering the amount of new mines that need to be brought to production. I mean, in some minerals, it's a little easier. So in copper and nickel, et cetera, there's been interest in those minerals for a very long time. So there's a lot of studies out there on projects and projects that perhaps have been mothballed, projects that could be restarted. But in lithium, obviously, there was very little traditional production. So you're working from a very low base. And so there really is a major scramble going on to secure supply, because at the end of the day, if you're going to spend $150 billion on plant, the last thing you want in the world is then when the day you switch it on, you don't have any feedstock.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so how do you overcome that in terms of not having enough feedstock? I mean, what are the...
Well, hopefully, we see major investment in new mines. The problem is, and always with the sector is, and you kind of highlighted this earlier with the need to be able to talk to your investors, is there is a tendency, particularly in the junior mining sector, to overpromise and expectations that people will be able to deliver production quickly. And obviously, it just takes a long time to bring productions on. So fortunate in the case with Atlantic Lithium, and we've been working on the project since 2016. So first production the year after next, we're doing relatively well. It's less than 10 years. But it's very difficult to do things much more quickly than that unless you have a project that's already been worked on historically. So it'll be very interesting to see how the sector does over the next 10 years. You know, people will bring forward new supply and there is a rush to do so, but you just can't bring it on quickly enough to meet the demand.
Mm-hmm. And what about technology? How is technology changing the sort of, you know, the way you mine, basically?
Well, in terms of the mining technology, I mean, a lot of it is, in terms of the hard rock projects that we have, it's just a very straightforward project. So there isn't really anything very complicated about it. It's a very low strip project to begin with. I think over mine life, it's 8-1. So the extraction methods are quite simple in our case, because there's very broad intersections, there isn't much waste. That's a very positive thing. Because it's an all spodumene deposit rather than a mix of lithium bearing minerals, all we have to do is to put it through DMS. So this is effectively a gravity circuit, which is a relatively short process, and at which point we can ship. So that's a straightforward one. With the brines in Latin America, they're looking at technology which effectively accelerates the process by which you can extract the lithium. So there seems to be a lot of success on that in sort of pilot project stage at the moment. Often in the mining industry, it's quite difficult to get them to work at scale. So, you know, there's always teasing problems with that. So again, it takes time. But there is technology coming forward that hopefully will simplify that process. There are other sources of lithium as well. So there's lithium in clays and sort of what we call the unconventional projects. None have been brought to production yet, but lots of people working on technology to bring those to production too. So absolutely, you know, there is ongoing changes to technology on the processing side so that we can bring on more lithium sooner.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We sort of wanted to talk about, you know, obviously the highs and lows of your career in the mining. Can you sort of, you know, give us some highlights of, you know, what's been...
Oh, the good ones are always, you know, the ones you like to remember are always the wins, aren't they? So obviously working with Antofagasta and putting the Pelambres mine in production, which fundamentally changed the company, was fantastic. Working on Brandgate, which was the first real AIM success, also was a highlight. The very rapid, advancement from 20 million to 2.5 billion in the sale of the company, of the uranium company, Uramin, was obviously a highlight. And indeed, having the success at Polo in terms of the very big dividend plays outs on projects that I sold on was a highlight. But there's always another project, and you know, not every project works out. It has to be said. And if you work in exploration, if you take on exploration risk, there's always a risk that the projects don't come through.
Mm, okay. Indeed, there is one company I want to get your thoughts on. I'll leave that till the end to hopefully try and entice people to listen until the end. Of course, it's a very well known lithium project. But just before we get on to that, let's just finish off by talking on what's to come in Atlantic Lithium. You talked about production 2024, but of course you have other projects as well. So what are the focuses going to be, the main objectives? You know, we are at the end of 2022 now. Where would you like to be in a year's time? What are the key milestones that you think you're looking out for, but also investors can keep an eye out for?
So I think that the big ones for next year are, so we did a 47,000 meter drill program, which we completed. We've put out all but I think about 10,000-11,000 meters of the drill results, and they've been really very good. So obviously we already had 30 million tons in resource. What we saw in those is we saw some very sweet spots coming out of the deposit. So we had over 6%, I think 6.7% helium content, which is exceptional in parts of the resource. But more importantly, we saw that it continuing at depth. And what's really nice about the project is you have very long intercepts on the main pegmatite body, which I think is very encouraging. It just shows to show that the potential to increase that resource. So by early next year, we should have all the results back from the lab, and obviously we'll be putting those out into the public domain. And I would hope relatively early in Q1 next year, we'll be putting out the revised resource statement. So you can expect to see more resource put up into the reserve category, but also an increase in the size of the overall resource as well. So I think that's very encouraging. We will continue to do exploration activity. We've only actually worked on something like 2% of our license area. And so we've had a very successful exploration team that have continued to systematically work through that area. So we think there's lots of potential to grow that resource, and potentially in the longer term, you know, very speculatively, I would say 2-3 times, you know, over the life of the project is very possible. After that, obviously, all the steps to take us to DFS. So you'll see lots of news as we complete those studies and put that information out. Obviously, hopefully early next year, we'll bring in the Sovereign Wealth Fund, which we've also said would be a big endorsement to us. We already have the endorsement from ASSOR increasing its stake after reviewing the project, which I take as a big endorsement already. Hope to complete all the permitting cycle by around September. So at that time, we'll be fully permitted to go to production. Not expecting any problems, but you know, permitting is a very important stage. The government takes it seriously. We put our mining license application in September. They came back with their comments upon it, and we're just about, I think, to file all our answers to those questions that they put up. So that would be a great thing. And by the end of next year, you know, with a bit of luck and a fair wind, we hope to be breaking ground on the project. And it's a relatively short build time. It's not a terribly complex plant, as we talked about before. Mm-hmm. So we'd hope by the second half of 2024, we'd be ramping up. I think there's a couple of things which kind of feed through on what we're doing in terms of upside is one, obviously, the resource is getting bigger. And we can also look at, as a result, higher production scenarios. Mm-hmm. So we're currently looking at 2 million tons of throughput a year. It's not a lot more capex to go to 3 million tons. We just have to work out if that makes sense. Obviously, we've got a bigger resource now. We're continuing to add to the resource, but obviously that would add a lot to profitability if we were able to go down that road. Not saying we will. It might be premature to do that. We might continue with 2 million tons and then effectively add production capacity later. But these are things that we'll be studying in the course of the year.
Excellent. Well, that's a lot. That's an awful lot to look forward to. Thank you for whetting investors' appetites with that there. So I do just want to finish talking about Premier African Minerals. It's a company who are regularly on Stockbox here, and it has a huge retail investor following. I know you were chairman of Prem until recently, until April this year. So I want to, and this is obviously about Atlantic Lithium, but for the Prem investors there, it's nice to get another opinion on it. You were involved with the company for a couple of years. So, I mean, what was it like working for Prem then and sort of going through that process? Of course, they are about to turn on their pilot plant to get that first production of lithium from spodumene, so the same stuff that you're dealing with at Atlantic. But give us a bit of a just tell us what it was like, what you think of the project, what you think of the team and the resource and really your time with the company.
Very happy to. So George Roach is an old friend of mine. Mm-hmm. George was actually worked on the putting together of the projects for the uranium company that we talked about earlier. So that's when I know George from. So George is a very passionate entrepreneur. He loves his projects. So a couple of years ago, he needed somebody to stand in as chairman. So I stood in for him and was very happy to be supportive and was always very keen on the Zulu Lithium project because you could see the potential there for doing something potentially of size. So actually, I appreciate they're going to pilot plant this time, but obviously speculatively, the potential for the project being actually quite a big lithium player. And we've seen a number of projects come on stream or being taken to production in Zimbabwe, and there's a lot of focus in Zimbabwe at the moment. So I actually saw George the other day and he gave me a bit of an update. And so he's obviously running through all the issues you do as you take a project to production. So I wish him well with that. So working with George is always a pleasure because I say we're old friends. I really like the Zulu project, so I wish him well with it. I think it's a good project. I came off the board in honesty because as I mentioned earlier, the founder of Atlantic passed away at the beginning of the year, and I really needed to reallocate my time to Atlantic to be able to make sure that it ran smoothly. It's always difficult when you lose somebody who's the founder of the company, who was also the CEO. So it's taken a lot more time up than I originally intended when I took on the company, but it's been a pleasure to do so. It's a good team, but yes, I like Zulu. I think it's a good project. I know it's a very popular stock, and I wish George and the company very well with it.
Good. Well, it's nice to get your opinion on that, and let's hope that they do manage to get that pilot plant up and running in February, March time, I think. So it's a fairly swift. Excellent. Well, I think we're pretty much up on time. Katrina, do you have any further sort of points you'd like to ask Neil or not?
Just one more question in terms of, you know, what are you looking forward to in 2023 for Atlantic Lithium?
So what I would look forward to is, to be frank, I mean, we've got some real milestones there that I look forward to achieving at the beginning of the year. Very much look forward to seeing the resource statement updated. So that gives an idea of, you know, the revised size, and then that leads into, well, you know, could you look at higher production scenarios or not? Does it make sense to do that? I think that leads into what we're doing with the definitive feasibility study, which we're planning to finish around mid-year. There's a series of, if you like, studies within that, which we'll announce on, but are probably more detailed in terms of the investor. And then obviously around the end of September, we would look to complete all our permitting. So that would be a big step too. And then finally actually able to break ground on the project before the end of the year would be fantastic. So, you know, that would set up nicely for the following year and being in production in the second half. One of the things we have to look at is we have some drip shipping ore material on top of the deposit, which normally we would put to one side and process later, but it is actually potentially direct shipping ore at the moment, so might provide early revenue. All these things are studies that we'll be looking at during the course of the year. As I say, we are very fortunate to have brought in someone who's actually run a lithium mine, because there aren't many of them around. And so I'm looking forward to working with him as well. So it's a great year. I mean, we've got a very good team. It's a very broad team. It's, you know, investors are very interested. We like keeping them up to date. And obviously, I think next year what we'll also see is an increase in terms of the institutional holding in the company as we move towards a production and being a cash flow generative company.
Wonderful.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. Neil Herbert, the Executive Chairman of Atlantic Lithium, painting a very good picture there of what the company is all about and your history as well in this mining space. So I hope we can catch up again in the not too distant future when perhaps some significant things happen with the company, or indeed we can have a more broader discussion on the mining and commodities space in the near future. But thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much too.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Per Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.